I'm very sorry to hear that people pass on, but I'm very grateful if their family feels like I can help them. You know, so again, yes, it's sad that people pass, but it's sadder when their story gets missed. One of my things on my business cards and everything says that every life story deserves to be told and told well. And I really believe that. Find one place to start. Think of the story that is the most compelling to you, that means the most to you, that resonates the most deeply with you, and tell it like you're telling it to the person who understands you the most. You know, I love the writing, I love the social work, and the convergence of those two things and the celebrant work. It just feels wonderful. We are too often encouraged to look at the differences and not the similarities, the disconnects rather than that connection. You know, one of the definitions I've heard of God is that the collective spirit of everybody.
If you're up for a challenge and you want to get out of your comfort zone, enroll in the American Reel 21-Day Challenge through our free private Facebook group. Your challenge will be to post a live 60-second video each day for 21 straight days to build skills of confidence, leadership, and grow your network in a safe and secure environment. You'll quickly see how turning up each day gives you more clarity, purpose, and drive to come into your own. Our team is here to help support you and provide you with the tools you need to become more present, committed, so you can value the power of your own story. Click on the link below to join American Reel Live Tribe 21 and start your 21-day challenge today. This week on American Reel, we bring you journalist, storyteller, and celebrant, Steve Lawrence. Steve discusses the lost art of storytelling from across cultures and throughout the centuries, and why it is so important to continue the tradition in this technology age. He also expresses the need for jokes and humor, and provides detail about his work as a celebrant, where he co-creates ceremonies, primarily for the celebration of life. Everything Steve writes, including his sports column, is centered around people, and the talents and contributions they make to this world. After watching this episode, you may just consider your own legacy, including what quote will reside on your tombstone. And now, without further ado, I bring to you Mr. Steve Lawrence. This is American Reel. I am Roger Brooks, and today our special guest is Steve Lawrence, journalist, storyteller, and celebrant.
That's
Steve,
right.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Roger. Thanks for having me.
I'm really fascinated about what you do because, number one, you're a writer and you're a storyteller, two of my most favorite things in the world, and you do them for a living.
Right.
But let's, if you can, talk about where storytelling came from.
Oh, it's in the DNA. I grew up downriver in Owego, and I had a grandfather who was a, forgive the cliche so early, a larger-than-life character who was a police officer, a jailer, a farmer, a fiddle player, storyteller, tall tales. And I remember growing up and all these kids would be saying, wow, did you see that Clint Eastwood movie and that John Wayne movie? And I'd be like, my grandfather could kick both of those guys, you know, easily. And so I had this real life role model when I saw how he engaged people with stories and how people would just lean in and really listen to what he said. And my mom picked up on that, decided at 4 years of age she was going to be a school teacher, and did so, graduated college at 20 and went right into it. And one of the biggest blessings for me in terms of evolution as a storyteller that I didn't realize how valuable it was at the time, but I was 8 years old. She went back to get her master's degree, and her thesis was regional folklore. All these ghost stories from the area and all these old stories. And I remember going with her to these beautiful farmhouses with these couples in their 80s and 90s, homemade quilts, apple pie, the whole Americana. And these people would be so grateful that their stories were going to stay alive, you know, that somebody was interested in. My mom was putting them into her thesis, you know, into print form. And I just remember leaving there and remember and starting to get the idea how much people's stories mattered to them, and how so many times they'd love to be able to tell them, but if they can't for whatever reason, having somebody else interested enough and willing to do what it takes to bring those stories forth mattered to them a lot. And then I started, you know, that's how it turned into journalism stuff, and journalism evolved into celebrant work. And so that's sort of the basis.
Fantastic. So tell us a little bit more about your grandfather. What do you remember most about him?
Oh, when he was a fiddle player, he would gather six or eight or ten, or what, nine. I think he had nine grandchildren. And he would gather us in a circle, semicircle, and we would sit there. And he would play round and round the mulberry bush, the monkey chased the weasel, that's the way the money goes. And then he would plink somebody on the head with the bow, but he would plink the string with his finger, so we thought it was the bow hitting us in the head that made that noise. So when he wasn't around, we'd take that bow, and we could never get that to work. But it was just always such a magical experience. This thing was like a magic wand, you know, that he would bring us all in and tell stories with the fiddle and all this stuff. And when I learned to play guitar, one of my goals was to play with him and with my uncle at one of their square dance things. But it was at that point that I realized that those guys had no idea how to get even close to being in tune. So, but that was okay. It was still authentic.
That's funny. So as a kid, did you spend a lot of time with him? I understand he was also a police officer.
He was. He did. You know, and in fairness, my other grandfather brought some real balance to this. He was a very gentle man who would read to me a lot, and he just had a much softer side, and that was a great piece of balance for me too. You know, I had this John Wayne type guy, but I had another grandfather who was much more emotions on the sleeve type guy, and so it was a great balance to have them. One lived half a mile from me and one 10 miles, so I saw them both a lot. You know, the
big influence on your life.
Yeah, really big influence. And I didn't come to understand that balance until later. You know, I always had the stories about the big tough guy and all that. But the other grandfather, as I grew older and got into my social work studies and all that, I realized that a lot of that compassion came from my mom and her school teaching and how many kids she touched who felt abandoned until they got to her class. And I realized I was fortunate to get that sort of balance, because I, you know, where I am now, I love to draw from both sides of that coin.
Sure. Why do you think storytelling is such a lost art?
I think it's a lost art because just in my own lifetime, there were no computers, there was some TV and things, but, you know, when I went to school to get my certification as a celebrant, part of what we did was look back across the centuries and across the cultures to look at storytelling and ritual and rite of passage and ceremony to find out, you know, how different cultures incorporated storytelling into, you know, through their generations of things. And the storytellers were very revered to keep these traditions alive and keep the stories alive. And I think now I have a phone in my pocket where I can find 10 million stories on there at any given time, like you do. You know, and I think it's people, that's another example of, I'm not an anti-tech guy at all, but technology can make people pretty lazy. You know, instead of learning how to tell a story, it's easy to have somebody else do it or just push a button and watch it.
Right. Yeah, and I think your description of how stories were passed down, it's something that has really been lost, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. And I have a mentor, James Bonnet, and he wrote a book called Stealing Fire from the Gods. And he talks about in his book that, writers, and I'm sure you could appreciate this, get our inspiration from all kinds of stories. Mm-hmm. All the stories that we were told as children growing up, you know, they're all inside of us somewhere. So when it comes time for us to write our own work, a lot of that will come through. Do you feel that way?
I really do. And when somebody, like another thing, my daughters would tell you, too many jokes, you know, but I mean, joke telling is another art that can really engage people and be funny. And even if I've heard a story before, or I've heard a joke before, I'll listen to it, because maybe I'm going to hear it in a better form than I told it. You know, and there have been several stories I've listened to thinking I already know this story, but then I heard another piece of it that let me add another layer to it, and I was able to embellish it and make it better. And so, and also, so I think it's, you know, by paying attention to the art of storytelling, we can keep refining it.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Do you have any good jokes?
Good jokes? Well, the one I heard recently that I thought was cute was that a fellow said he went to see a magic show, and the magician was a Latino gentleman who said, "I'm going to vanish on the count of three, uno, dos," and he disappeared without a trace.
I love it.
All right.
Very good.
That counts as a semi-good joke.
Very good, very good. You are a celebrant,
yes,
and
sir.
A lot of people don't know what that means. Right. I've had a chance to do some research about that and yourself and what you do. But for those who don't know what a celebrant is, please explain.
Okay. Celebrant is a profession that's originated in Australia 35 years ago, thereabouts. And what it is, it's really a person who helps people in the process of co-creating ceremonies. And I do weddings, I do retirement parties, I do things like that, but I primarily do celebration of life ceremonies, funerals. And so what I do is channel my inner social worker, because I have a degree in that, many years of experience, and my writer, and I sit with families and I say, you know, this, we can do this in a way that will be a beautiful farewell gift to your loved one and a gift to you to feel like you really dug deep. And then we go through this outline that I have, and I get to know the person through their loved ones. We talk about their sense of humor, funniest story they left behind, what's the most profound lesson they taught that you'll never forget, what's the best story you have about their childhood, what's something you're always going to tell your family about their values, what they held sacred. And sometimes I've done these in conjunction with clergy. They'll bring clergy in to do some scripture, and they'll bring me in to do the life story, making the story the centerpiece of the ceremony. More often than not, it's just me. And I'm ordained, internet ordained, to do scripture and stuff, and I have lots of respect for, I've done ceremonies for families who are Jewish and families who are various different faiths. And I have respect for all that. So I can read their works if they want. But primarily, the ceremonies are, you know, meant to really, the terminology I use with people is, let's paint a colorful picture of this person's life. You know, and I say, you can give me big brush strokes. And we get to a point in the ceremony where I say to people, I know how much those guests in attendance would like to contribute to this, would like to step out of the role of spectator into participant, but I also understand people's comfort zone.
Sure.
So I say, so if you want to come up and speak, you can, but if you don't, please give me one word or one sentence that's always going to make you think of this person. And here they come. And then this word inspires somebody else to say another one. And that inspires somebody to say a sentence. And that becomes an anecdote, and that becomes a story. And if it goes well, it becomes an interactive experience where people are really happy to say, you know what, this is way easier than I thought it was, and nobody expects me to be polished and articulate. People expect me to be real.
Yeah, that's great.
You know? And that's what, like when you and I connected, you know, and you know, you do American Real and I do real life ceremonies, I said, we're on the same page for sure.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's kind of the essence of a celebrant ceremony.
It's really fascinating how you're able to pull all of that information together in such a short period of time. What do you typically have? A couple of days, I would assume?
Yeah. The one I did recently that I just have to tell you about that was one of the most profound experiences I've had in all my years of doing this. I got a phone call from a woman who said her brother-in-law was in end-stage illness. He was going to be buried at Green Springs National Cemetery. So without embalming and everything, that's a shorter time frame. And she said, will you be available to help us? And I said, yeah, I will. So I get a call from her on Wednesday. He had passed. Can I come to Skinny Atlas on Thursday, meet with the family, do my information gathering, go home, compose the ceremony, and have it ready 23 hours later?
Wow.
And I said, yeah. And when I was, sure. So fortunately, my schedule was such that I could do that. But I mean, I end up writing about 3,000 words. And I know to a lot of people that number doesn't mean much, but it's, I don't know, 6 or 7 pages of stuff looking at various parts of this person's life. And one of the things that happened that made me, you know, we've all had our experiences like I'm in the right place at the right time. The week before that, I had stopped in the visitor center, Tompkins County, to see some friends and pick up some stuff. And there was a calendar of the Erie Canal Way Trail. Beautiful. 12 photos, different seasons, different looks, bike trails. And I said, wow, are these free? Or are these for somebody? And I took it, threw it in the back of my car. That's nice. I don't go there. Beautiful calendar. Free. So I'm meeting with the family. And I'm asking about what their loved one held sacred, what he liked to do, and all this. And they said one of the things he loved was that he also loved people's stories. He loved to hear where people came from and what their dreams were and all this. And they said one of his favorite things to do was to ride his bicycle on the Erie Canalway Trail and talk to people. And I said, oh, I have something in my car for you. And now I knew why I was there. And the fact for them that they had brought that up, and now this calendar is on their dining room table, that made that connection so much deeper.
It's meant
so
to be.
More quickly. Meant to be, exactly. You know, and that's, and those are the kind of things that happens a fair amount. And one of the things, Roger, I'm going to tell you, and I say this from a place of deep gratitude and not any sort of, you know, I'm not coming from a boastful place or anything, but if people are walking out of a ceremony, guests or family members, and they say to me, I can't believe you didn't know that person because you got it, you nailed it, you know. And that's just, that feels like a real blessing to have the kind of connection
sure.
with the family where they're willing to go deep enough with me in sharing, you know, their thoughts and the stories that they would love to tell if they could. But to be able to do it on their behalf just feels wonderful.
Yeah, and what a special talent to be able to do that, pull it all together. Can you walk us through a little bit more of when you're in the moment, so when you're working on this, mm-hmm. whether, I don't know if you do it, you know, later in the evenings or throughout the day, but what are some of the techniques you use to pull together from your outline? How do you turn an outline into a story?
It's a three-part process, actually, and I'll sit down and I'll look at my 7 pages of outline that I have, or 6, whatever it is, and I'll pull this anecdote, and we'll put that in the person's early life and their school experience and then their college and their early adulthood and their family life and their profession and their hobbies and their retirement years and I'll put it like that, and then I'll start tying it together. And then after I get kind of where I want to be, usually the morning of the ceremony, I'll do my final edit. And a lot of times, like if somebody tells me that they have some Native American spiritual beliefs or something, and they'll tell me a story about this, I might try to find out what the spirit animal is that this person, that story might resonate with them or something. I try to pull from whatever knowledge I have of different cultures and different belief systems and try to find something to tie in, or some song lyrics that might help out there, or some some poem that's relevant. And one of the other things that I do is I encourage loved ones, friends, and family to make some contribution. Like if they have something they want me to read on their behalf, glad to do it. Some song lyric that
you'll include that in the
we'll
piece.
We'll put that in. And several times I've told people, come on up if you want to do this. I'll bring up somebody if you want to stand there with you. If not, I'm right here. And if you change your mind, hand it to me and we'll do it. It'll happen. So they know that the way they want the ceremony to come together, it will, in whatever form that takes.
Does it ever get emotional for you?
Yeah, it does. It does. There'll be times when somebody's around my age, their kids are around the age of my kids, and I'll think of all these opportunities that I'm sure they were looking forward to that aren't there. And it's interesting that you ask me that, because I hear that a lot. People say it sounds depressing. I mean, you didn't say that. You asked me,
sure,
if it got emotional. And my answer is that it does, but what's more emotional to me and what's sadder to me is when you go to a ceremony and you know this person lived this really interesting, colorful, fascinating life, and you're waiting for it to get there, and it never does. And they talk about something else, and they don't get there, and then missed opportunity.
Right.
And some families, that's what they want. They want some scripture and stuff, and that's how they want to grieve, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. Other families don't know what they want. They don't. They just know that they're numb, and they want somebody to take them by the hand. And a lot of times the funeral director will say, well, you're Protestant, here's a card for this person. You're Jewish, here's a rabbi's card. You're Catholic, here's a priest. And increasingly, they will now say, there's this new thing called celebrant, and we know somebody who can do that. And I know a couple of other people who do what I do, and I've seen their cards in funeral homes. And the more I am able to cultivate relationships with funeral providers, and they know what I do, then they're much more willing to be able to say to people, I think this is the person that can do what you want.
Yeah. Does it ever get emotional for the families?
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes they'll come up and they'll be, the information gathering session, our meeting we do, sometimes turns into sort of grief counseling, because some things pull, and I don't claim to be that.
Right.
I don't say that's what I do, but sort of is, mm-hmm. And I have a background in some of that. And so a lot of people will say things that they've been wanting to say for a long time, and they'll sort of want to tell their loved one something through me that they've wanted to say,
So you have a really important role.
Yeah, I feel like I do. And I feel like another thing that feels like I feel such gratitude is that I have never walked in to do a ceremony feeling the least bit unprepared. I always feel like I have every possible T crossed and I dotted that I could do. I mean, I'm not saying it couldn't be done better. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that by the time I get there, I'm thinking, I brought everything I had to this. And the feedback I get is, like I said, people say, when my family suffers a loss, we're calling you. I'm in the pipeline. The funeral directors have told me I'm in a pipeline for a lot of these coming up. Mm-hmm. And that feels great, because if people, another thing that feels great, and I tell the funeral home providers how much I appreciate our mutually beneficial arrangement, is that is that I know that if they felt like there was any chance I was going to put any of their guests out of their comfort zone, or I was going to do anything that was going to make people wonder why that funeral home provider had this guy come in there, then they're not going to call me.
Yeah.
You know, that referral pipeline is going to dry up quickly. But we have a great relationship, you know, because they know some families are always going to want something entirely different.
Sure.
Than what I do, but others are going to really want, you know, what I can help them do. And they do get really emotional. And sometimes the stories they tell are funny. And other times they're heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there have been times that I've told people I wasn't comfortable with that particular story, and I would write it in a way that I was comfortable with, and then I'd run it by them, and then let's see about this.
Because right.
Sometimes people still have some issues that they're trying to work out, and that's not really...
Sure, sure. But what an honor to be able to do this for families and help them through this process. You know, I've also attended funerals where I know that people were uncomfortable, or even family that has passed, and you know, everyone looks who's going to do the eulogy, and mm-hmm. you know, sometimes people feel forced into doing it because no one else will do it. And what a nice alternative that you offer.
Yeah, thanks. Another thing, Roger, that I'd like to do is sometimes I can coach people that didn't think they had it in them to go up and do that, but they do.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm able to open them up a little bit in terms of, you know, again, remembering that nobody really expects you to be Winston Churchill up there. You mm-hmm. know, people expect you to bring it. And some people have said, I didn't think I could do that, but I did, you know, and they're pleased about it. But it is a real honor to be able to do that, because you know, I just remember as a child, I didn't want to go to funerals. You know, like when my first grandfather passed, the real gentle guy, they said, well, funerals make people feel better. And I'm sitting there and they're talking about something else, not even him. And I was like, how's this supposed to make me feel better?
Mm-hmm.
And then when my tough guy grandfather died, I at least wrote something for the minister to read, and that felt a little better, you know. And then I mentioned to you in our initial emails when my mom, who was the beloved educator and school teacher and great storyteller, passed at age 58, a month after being diagnosed, you know, a complete shock to everybody. I knew that her story was so big and so colorful that I had to take a shot at it. There was nobody else that could do it. You know, I mean, the minister knew her, we loved him, but he knew this much of it, you know, and other family members knew more. So I just took a deep breath and went up and gave about 10-minute eulogy that I had it all written down, and I didn't even pull it out of my pocket. It just came through.
What were some of the things you talked about?
I talked about, I just remember the theme was that when she was 4 years old, she said, it's time for me to go to school. And everybody said, it's not time, you know. We're not ready. And then at 16, she was going to go to college. Well, it's not time, you know. We're not ready. And then at 58, she's only going to live a few more weeks. You know, it's not time. You know, none of us are ready. But the takeaway was that we never know what's coming.
Yeah.
And if you're going to be ready.
Yeah.
But, you know, you find ways to move forward. And it just... And I remember talking a lot about how her stories, you know, that basis she had about the regional folklore. She used to take her sixth grade students up to the Evergreen Cemetery in Owego, which is spectacular. You know, it has the Indian Girls Monument that overlooks the river and the village, and it has a Civil War cemetery, and it has the longest epitaph in the world that I, like, somehow channeled at her ceremony and could hardly believe that. But,
Tell us what happened there.
There's the world's longest epitaph exists in the thing, and I wrote it into her eulogy, and I thought I was going to have to read it, but I didn't read it. I just remembered it, and then I walked out of there, and I was like, I don't know how that happened, but I'm glad it did. And I just remember sharing stories about how people would come up to me as adults, and they would say, you know, when I stepped into your mother's classroom, I felt like I was nobody. And by the time I left, I felt like I could be president. You know, just that. And
she was very uplifting.
Yeah, yeah. She just was really, you know, another woman told me the story about when she came to school, one of seven kids, no money, and some hand-me-down her brother's coat, and she came in the back door, didn't want anybody to see her. Next day, beautiful new coat, pink coat that she'll never forget. You know, just that kind of stuff. And so the eulogy sort of brought that together, just how somebody's life's work can leave this legacy, you know, forever. And now, you know, 27 years later, my daughters never got to meet her. But every time they've gone to WeGo to visit other family members, or somebody has come up to them and said, "Don't know if you ever knew this, but this is what your grandmother did for me, you know, and this is the role she played in my life." And so now my daughter's an MSW oncology social worker, and also that compassion that came through her, you know, lives on. And it's just it's a nice feeling.
You talked about legacy. Mm-hmm. How important is one's legacy while they're alive, before it's too late, before they're, you know, having someone give a eulogy?
Mm-hmm. To me, it's really important, and that's why, you know, I, in addition to all the newspaper columns I do and everything, I did a book of short stories a while ago, and that was why. They weren't stories that fit into any newspaper feature, and they didn't fit into any, you know, celebrant work, but they were just stories that I always wanted to leave behind, you know, so I think it's important. I know some people sort of feel like they're passing through and they don't really care what kind of a footprint they leave, you know, and
is that selfish in some ways?
To not really care about your legacy? I don't know. I guess it depends on how people view themselves. And, you know, I like to view myself as, you know, without getting really too esoteric, you know, one of the definitions I've heard of God is that the collective spirit of everybody. You know, take the gender out and take all the personification out, and, you know, like the Native Americans, the Great Spirit. You know, and I like to think that if you're a part of that greater whole, you know, then your contribution, if it's put together in ways, either, you know, your stories or your life's work or whatever you do, as a contribution to the greater good, then I think legacy matters a lot.
Mm-hmm. No, good point. And to your last point, I feel we're all connected, right? It doesn't matter what race, religion, ethnic background you are, right? We're all connected. Do you think people have a hard time with that? And it sounds like you have a similar thought.
I do have a similar thought. Yeah. I think we are too often encouraged to look at the differences and not the similarities, at the disconnects rather than that connection that you're talking about. And really interesting, one of the experiences I had that really was instrumental in my storytelling evolution was I used to work at Cornell in the athletic department for many years in the 80s. And I started running with a blind student who had been blind since he was 6 years old. And I spent 5 years traveling around the U.S. and running with him as his guide runner. And we went to the Paralympics in Seoul, which has been fun watching that on TV again, you know, back. But it was the summer games and we ran there and we competed there. And I spent 5 years around people who had varying degrees of visual impairment. And a lot of them were totally blind. And skin color and whether you had a Rolex or a Timex or whether you drove a Lexus or a Toyota.
None of that mattered.
None of that mattered. It didn't matter at all. You know, and it just really made for some really authentic, beautiful connections that might not have happened given all this other stimuli that can be so distracting.
And do you think at that time, did that open your eyes to more than you were might have been thinking about?
It did. It did. You know, at that point, I already had a social work degree and stuff, and I was pretty settled into the way I wanted to be in the world. But it did teach me a lot because there were a lot of people that we met on these journeys around the country and around the world for competitions, who were very used to being treated a certain way because they were so beautiful, or their wardrobe such, or this or that, and they had to really learn how to readjust, you know, because none of that mattered.
Yeah.
And it was just, and like one of the anecdotes that came out of that I'll never forget was my friend had pledged his fraternity with his friend TJ, and they were best friends for 3 years. And toward the end of their college career, somebody said, you know, I'm going to miss everybody. The frat brothers are together. And they said, where's TJ tonight? And they said, well, he's with his girlfriend because they're spending time together. You know, they're not going to really see each other after college. And so, and Rick said, my blind friend, said, well, how come they're not going to pursue their relationship? You know, they have the same sense of humor, the same politics. They're a great couple. He said, well, sadly, some people and her family aren't on board with her being with a black guy. And Rick said, really? And they said, you didn't know that some families still weren't evolved on that? He said, I didn't know TJ was black.
Wow.
3 years.
Yeah.
And
well, that says it all.
To him.
Yeah.
To him, you know, how could that possibly matter?
Yeah.
So I think getting a little off track, but
no, but it's important because you know, I think it all ties together. I did a little segment this week on equality as one of our pillars here at American Real, and you know, it's just enough. It's not discussed enough in definitely not in my circles, but I think it's really important that when you have people that believe in equality, true equality. And there is no racial bias, there is no religious tension. I think we need to talk more about that, and especially in your work. I mean, for you to be able to go in and it doesn't matter what faith the person is. The person is the person. People are good no matter where you live, where you're from, you know, what ethnic background you come from, what beliefs you have. So you know, why not celebrate that, but why not help others try to see, you know, a more positive aspect to that?
Yeah, that's another thing that's been really helpful to me is, like, I, you know, living and working around Cornell and seeing so many different people from different cultures, and you can sit in a restaurant and hear four different conversations in four different languages, you know, And I know a lot of people have some assumption about people and this group or that, and the people I've met that come to school at Cornell, they're not there because they're some Ivy League entitled family. They're there because they want to learn agriculture and go save their country.
Right.
You know, a lot of the people who, you know, the preeminent agriculture school in the country, they want to learn how to use their knowledge to grow more crops and save more people, you know. So it's just that I've been really fortunate to step out of some of those smaller boxes that people like to put one another in and see a much more multi. And another thing, living in Ithaca, you see this real, I don't live in Ithaca, but I've worked here for so long, you see this real interesting balance of intellectual, worldly families, and then the rural poverty 5 miles down the road, literally, you know, and so there's that's some real diversity that a lot of people think diversity, and they think skin color and religious differences and stuff, and there's a lot of socioeconomic diversity.
Absolutely.
That causes a whole lot of stress too.
Yeah, that's right. Let's talk about your writing a little bit more. So
okay.
you write as a journalist for the Ithaca Times.
Right. Right.
As a sports writer.
Loosely.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I have some people say to me, I don't really like reading your sports column because I like to know who scored how many points and who had how many rebounds. You don't talk about any of that. And I have other people say to me, I couldn't care less about sports, but I never miss your column because you write about people.
It's more human interest.
Yeah, it's more backstory, and it's more about, you know, how this person got there despite this obstacle or this problem or this injury or something. It's more about, you know, this person's, you know, using sports as a framework to write about people doing things they never thought they could do and meeting people they never thought they'd meet. And I write with an eye toward why should this person who is interested in art care about this person's sports accomplishments? You know, what is the central piece of that story that's going to connect those people? And I, in the reading I did about what you're doing, I mean, you're a connector, you know exactly what I mean.
Right.
You know, looking for that common piece of, you know, that, again, teamwork, discipline, reaching higher, although, so I'm sort of a sports writer, but I'm really, it's almost always about the people.
That's wonderful. Can you give us an example of a recent article?
Yeah. I did one that was real interesting to me, that there was a young woman who grew up in Ithaca playing Tompkins girls hockey, youth hockey, came up through, and they had this thing called the Cub Club, where these 8 and 9 year old girls teamed up with Cornell women hockey players, and they were their mentors, and they looked at these girls like they were huge stars. And they're D1 hockey players. They're good. A lot of them are in the Olympics now, you know, so they're good. And these little young girls looked up to these girls as like, wow, they keep their grades up. They do an academic, you know, challenging schedule. They do D1 athletics. I want to be like them. So this girl grows up, decides she's going to try out for the boys' hockey team at Ithaca High, makes the boys' hockey team, goes on to be the goalie for the women's team at the University of New Hampshire, and does some junior Olympic team coaching, and then came back to Cornell 2 weeks ago on the other side of the ice as an assistant coach for Harvard,
wow,
the arch rival. So just this journey from having looked up to these girls to being coaching against them, and just how all of these things that she took from this youth program served her in being a mentor herself.
Great
so
story.
Just that sort of human interest thing.
And walk us through, I mean, are you doing your research like anyone, and you come across, okay, this assistant coach is coming through, she now works for Harvard, she used to be a player at Cornell, connecting the dots and saying, okay, that's my next story.
Yeah, a lot of times I'll do that, and other times, you know, I've been the sports columnist there, and it's a weekly paper. The publisher owns 10 papers. The Ithaca Times is the flagship, and then there are 9 community papers around, so I write for a bunch of them for that whole publishing group. But after 25 years of it, I get all kinds of Facebook messages and emails about, here's a story that you should know about or that you might want to know about. And my radar has been refined over the years. People will come up to me and they'll be like, how are you? It's so nice to see you. I love your writing. And I'm like, wait for it. Oh, yeah. And my kid's doing this.
Right. Yep.
And that's okay. I'm looking for stuff. You know, I'm looking for stories. And one thing that's an honor, I have to say, Roger, is that recently I went to Ithaca High to pick up a guest pass because I had to go meet with a coach. And in the principal's office was a yellow newspaper column that I had written 14 years earlier.
Wow, still, on the wall.
That's on the wall because it became a part of the family scrapbook.
Yeah.
You know, and I now write about kids who I wrote about their mother. Now I'm writing about the kid and just the family, you know, tradition and the progression and all that stuff. And it's just a really sweet way to be connected to the community.
So don't fun. You get gratification when you celebrate others?
Mm-hmm. I really do.
I think there needs to be more of this.
I agree.
In this world of, you know, constant negative news, right? And that's why we're doing American Real. It's alternative media where we could sit down and talk with folks like you who are doing great things, who are constantly challenged. I mean, your job is not easy. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to perform to be at the top of your game. And I think when people read your columns or if they're sitting in the church and listening to your work, I think it inspires people. to want to become better themselves. And I commend you for your work, because it's not easy work. And I'm sure you see, and you mentioned just now, that it's nice to see that gratification of someone who keeps an article for 14 mm-hmm. years or comes mm-hmm. up to you after all these years.
Yeah, it is. It feels really good. And it's interesting that you said, you said the word performance in there. And there are times I feel like, my writing is one thing. I can sit down and piece it together and edit it three times and then send it in. But like when I'm doing a ceremony and I'm at the podium, at the funeral home or the church or the state park or at the country club or wherever we're doing it, it does feel in a way like performance art. But I'm also really conscious about being in the background. Mm-hmm. The story is about this person, and I want to bring it in a way that really brings it to life. But if anybody ever said that felt like it was, more about you, I'd feel like I missed it. So I'm conscious of that. But you're right. It is. I really have to pull from a pretty wide range of skill sets to get the writing done and get it done on time and show up and do the public speaking component and, make the eye contact with the people there and all. But I just always really want people to feel like that. They're one of my things on my business cards and everything says that every life story deserves to be told and told well. And I really believe that, that whether somebody is a really high profile person that's everybody knows about, or somebody that grew up on a farm and never moved anywhere, their story is just as valuable.
Yeah. You wrote a couple of books. You wrote a children's book.
Yeah, a long time ago.
You mentioned earlier the stories the short mm-hmm. stories, mm-hmm. and then you helped co-write a book, correct?
Yeah, that was a recent project. Richie Moran is to college lacrosse what John Wooden might be to basketball, or Bear Bryant might be to football. He's a guy who played on a national championship, grew up in Long Island. Amazing story. One of the last of eight kids of Irish immigrants. His older brother was a World War II pilot who didn't make it back. And just gave Richie this real deep gratitude for everybody in his life. And I met him at Cornell when I started working there. And this guy had come as a high school lacrosse coach into Cornell, won three Division I national championships with Ivy League students against North Carolina, Virginia, Maryland, full scholarship teams, and took the game to a new level. And he has guys in his former player list who are CEOs, a four-star general, all these Fortune 500 guys who, the foreword of the book is written by Jeremy Schapp from ESPN, and Dick Schapp was his dad, and he says that one of our things on our poster said, Jeremy Schapp's quote was, when I think of the ultimate, he said, I've been in the business my whole life, followed my dad into the business. I've met everybody. When I think of the ultimate coach, I don't think of Scottie Bowman, Phil Jackson, or Bill Belichick. I think of Richie Moran. Boom. So Richie and I have been friends a long time, and he asked me if I would co-author his autobiography with him. And I told him, I know the kind of stories that he tells. I said, here's the deal. I'll sign on. It was May of 2016. I said, I'll sign on, but we're going to stay on my timeline, because we want to release this book when you turn 80 in January. And if we go on your timeline with every one of your stories, instead of releasing It's Great to Be Here when you turn 80, it'll be Where Am I when you turn 90, because he has volumes of stories. It ended up being a 350-page effort. Wow. With lots of photos and everything, and just testimonials from, again, people who command corporations, legions of army officers who still call him yes sir, no sir, and treat him like he's one of the most preeminent mentors in their lives.
Sounds like an amazing.
It was a great project.
Amazing man.
It was a great project.
Can you walk us through a little bit of that? process? What was that process? Are you meeting with him? Are you recording?
Yeah.
Are you
yeah,
writing?
Yeah. We had the good fortune to have the keys to the Ithaca Yacht Club, and we would go during the day. Things don't get busy there until afternoons, and we would go sit down by Cayuga Lake, and we would record it. And I put together an outline that I wanted to take him deep into his childhood and into, you know, his high school days and his playing days. And we have a whole chapter of testimonials from former players who've said some just beautiful things about him. And so we would record it, and then I sent it to a friend who's a transcriber. She'd send it back. I'd do the preliminary edit, and then we had some other friends to do editing. And I told him, we have to be at chapter 4 in July, chapter 8, you know, here, and this is, we have to be in production at this point. And we got it out for his 80th birthday, and we did a book signing at the Golf Country Club at Cornell. 335 books in 6 hours. People stood an hour and 45 minutes in line, and he signed nonstop. And it was just beautiful to see people who had come from all over the country to be a part of his book release. And people have been begging him for 20 years to do this. You know, like, Richie, your story is so profound. It needs to be told, and to be asked to be the person to take him through it. So, using lacrosse language, the book says, it's great to be here, by Richie Moran, with an assist from Steve Lawrence.
I love it.
So that was
a
great. And one of the funniest anecdotes was this gentleman came to the book signing, and he stood tall and straight, and he had a deep voice, and he said, "Steve, I'm Jay Paxton." And I said, I know who you are. He's a 4-star general.
Wow. He was a former player.
He just retired, and he came for the book signing. He said, "Steve, I want you to know that I think you're a great American for helping Richie with this book." And I said, "Jay, I've had a lot of 3-star generals tell me I was a great American, but you're the first 4-star general." He said, "Really?" And I said, "No." I said, "You generals aren't really used to having anybody bust on you, are you?" And he goes, "No, but maybe I'll get used to it in civilian life." So all these guys who have reached the heights of their professions,
yeah,
you know, were mentored by Richie. And what they all say is that, "I was a really good student, and I was a good lacrosse player, and I was a hard worker, but that guy taught me how to be a leader." You know, and so, and one of the most compelling pieces of that book, Roger, is just that Richie and I both cried through it. One of his players was named Eamon McEnany, and Eamon was in any conversation of the top of 5 lacrosse players that ever played. When he was a sophomore, Cornell lost in the semis of the NCAA tournament. He walked over to Coach Moran, said, "That's the last time we're going to lose when I'm wearing a Cornell uniform." Next 2 seasons, they ran the table. They won 42 games in a row in Division I. It's a Division I record. 40 years later, nobody's come close to that. 2 national titles in a row. Eamon McEnany died in the World Trade Center on September 11th. And 8 years before that, when there was the first attack, somebody tried to blow it up with a truck in the parking lot,
right,
in the parking garage. There was a stairwell full of smoke with people trapped in it. And Eamon McEnany got the men to rip the sleeves off their shirts, made smoke bandana-like things, filters, formed a human chain, and got 60 people out of the stairwells.
Wow.
And was held up as one of the heroes of that thing. And then he was a VP at Cantor Fitzgerald in 2011 and didn't get out. And Richie did his eulogy on ESPN. And it was like a son to him. He'd known Eamon since he was 9 years old. You know, so, like, just memories like that of a guy who's now over 80 and who is looked at by so many people as just a crucial role model for so many,
yeah,
you know. And another thing that we did that's been wonderful, on the website, where people order the books, says, "What would you like to say to Richie?" So we've got volumes of stuff that, "I'll never forget what you did for me when I was having a hard time, you know. Thanks so much for being there for my dad and his later," just stuff like that, you know, legacy stuff.
Yeah,
that Richie's family gets to read now and everything, and that's been a beautiful project.
I was going to say, what an honor to work on that project.
Yeah, yep.
And how are the book sales doing?
Great. He sold out his first printing. He's done book signings in Baltimore and Long Island, and where he grew up, and he has a bunch of players who now are running lacrosse leagues and stuff, and they just love having him come in and having these kids meet this guy.
Yeah.
Who you, as such a towering figure in the world of lacrosse, to be such an engaging, connected, down-to-earth, authentic, accessible guy. You know, it's a great experience for people. Mm. He's a character.
82 now.
81 now.
81.
Yep, just turned 81 down in Florida for a few weeks. He's proud. His grandson is Ryan Sposito, who's a senior at Ithaca and one of the state's best lacrosse players. He's going to play at West Point.
Wow.
Got in the military academy.
Great.
Yeah.
Good for him.
Yeah.
And here it is. It's Great to Be Here by Richie Moran with an assist from Steve Lawrence. What a great title.
Yeah, and I showed you my publicity photo with the lacrosse stick over my face so that
I like that.
If the IRS asks how much money I made, I can say that's not even me.
Great book. So speaking of the books that you wrote, all the writings you do, when you do a piece at a funeral, mm-hmm. is there any leave behind piece? Do you leave the family with something that they'll have as a memento?
Yeah, yes, I do. By the time I end up composing the whole ceremony and going across the whole spectrum of that person's life, it ends up about 3,000 words, roughly. And I leave a blank space where I say to people, again, I mentioned this, that I'd like to hear one word or one sentence or one anecdote that'll always make you think of this person. And as they come in, I write them all down. So I go home, and then I add that in, and I do my final edits. And then the family gets this 3,000-word piece with all these contributions from other people as a memento, as something. Because anybody who has gone through a loss knows that you're just numb mm-hmm. at that time.
Right. Especially so to be able to go back and
yeah,
read it.
Yeah, they can go nice. Back and reflect. And wow, somebody said this, and somebody remembered him as generous, and somebody else called him funny, and somebody else called him inspiring, and just, you know, all these things that really that tie it together. So the family ends up with that, and then I print them out. I have a giant stack of hundreds of personal stories that I just like looking at the piles of them, because it reminds me how lucky I am to be connected with so many families that reached out to me at that time.
Yeah. What's a typical day like for you?
Well, people ask me if I plan to retire anytime soon, and I say, well, actually, I've taken 3 hours of my retirement every day for the last 40 years, so that delayed me a little bit. But I do I'll get up, a lot of times I pop out of bed at 6 and do a lot of writing in the morning. I wake up pretty inspired, and I write a lot, and like especially if I'm composing a ceremony, I do a lot of that early because I wake up
before the day begins.
Yeah, and then I'll head into town and I'll go to my favorite coffee shop at Wegmans or something, and I'll engage several people and see if I can make them laugh or see if I can, you know, see what's going on there. And then I'll stop over at the Ithaca Times and see if anything's come through the pipeline there. And I do some part-time social work through the Racker Centers, which is an agency that serves people with different disabilities, and I do some community support work. I take some young people out into the community and work on socialization skills and all that, so that's a little part-time thing I do. Digging up a lot of stories, and so just a lot of connecting with people and a lot of looking for the next story.
What's the most challenging part of your work?
Most challenging part can be not knowing if I'm going to have a ceremony to do this week or if I'm going to have 3 in 6 days like I had last month. That's a little much.
Did so it. More that time could management of it could be, you know, if it rains.
And I have no control of it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm very sorry to hear that people pass on, but I'm very grateful if their family feels like I can help them, you know. So, again, yes, it's sad that people pass, but it's sadder when their story gets missed, you know. So So that's one of the things about my business that's a little, and that's why I do some weddings and stuff in the summer, and that's fun, you know, how this person's story and this person's story converge, and how are they going to take that, how are they going to tell that story collectively as they go forward. So I like that too, and people really like the way I blend their stories in weddings, so that's fun. But I never know. I mean, the weddings obviously are planned out for a long time, so there's plenty of time on that. But I never know if I'm gonna, like I told you just recently, got a call on a Thursday or Wednesday. Can you meet Thursday and do the funeral on Friday? And I had 3 and 6 days a little while ago. And other times I've gone, like I did one, what's today? Saturday. I did one a week ago today, and I haven't done one this week. But I might do 2 next week. So that's a challenge.
And what an art it is to be able to put these stories together, right? To craft it together. And, you know, when people sit back and listen or read, whatever it is, whether it's at a wedding or a funeral, it's, you know, I've been on your side of it. So I know the work that is involved in putting something like that together. I'm curious, do you feel that comes from a higher place, that you're able to be challenged in such a short period of time, as I mentioned, stealing fire from the gods? Do you think some of this information is coming from a place, a higher place, to give you the knowledge and wherewithal to perform?
I ask for it to do that. And there have been a lot of times, like one of the things that I really like to do when I sit down with the family, if I've never met the person, I say, can I see some photos? And I want to see photos of this person on their fishing boat. And I want to see photos of them hugging their grandkids.
Yeah.
And I want to see photos of them when they were on their bicycle in 1952. And I want to see, you know, pictures of them at their retirement party and at their wedding. And, you know, and I will ask, what do you got? What do you want me to tell about you? Send it to me. And I don't know where it comes from. I don't claim to be plugged in to that degree, but I am sure open to it, you know, wherever it comes from. And there's certain music that I listen to. Sometimes I get to a certain point in a ceremony. And are you familiar with the Burns sisters?
Sure.
From Ithaca? Okay, well, Terry Burns is the youngest of 12, and she's a good friend of mine, and her husband, Ron Christie. They have a wonderful, beautiful, spiritually connected album called Almost Home. Album, listen to me. CD called Almost Home. And there are a couple of songs on there. One is So Many Angels Out There. And I get to a certain point in my composition process and I put that CD in and I listen to it. And it takes me to a place where I feel really open to wherever it's coming from. You know, and I really do. Like that, like I mentioned to you, that higher power to me is the collective consciousness of all of us, and wherever it comes from, I'm very grateful for it. And I don't claim to hear so and so telling me what to write about him, but I try. You know, I try to listen, and I try to frame my questions to the families in ways that open it up for them to think about something about this person they might not have thought about otherwise.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I'm sitting across from you. A lot of the things that you're saying, I do. Mm-hmm. And it's just really amazing how people in similar crafts find similar ways of doing things. So, number one, I get up early. Number two, that's when I like to write.
Yeah.
I've been working on a novel for 7 years, and I don't get to spend too much time doing it, but when I do, I put on the music that I like.
Yep.
I get in this zone. And I feel like the words come, you know, naturally when I'm able to get in this, you know, comfort area. And yeah. And I could feel it that you get to a very similar place. And I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah, yeah. It is a kindred spirit thing. You know, one of the things I'll never forget, too, is when I was in my celibate training, the first 3 months were the fundamentals of celibacy. We talked about the different cultures and centuries and ceremony structure and all this. And then we would peel off some people to specialize in weddings, some people to specialize in funerals. And then there are other things like adoption ceremonies and things that are really interesting, blended family ceremonies, which I'm going to do at some point, I hope. But like the people in the weddings, they never had to worry about really digging in. Like, you know, okay, I'm meeting with the family in March, the wedding's in June.
Right.
Who can't do that? You know, I get that phone call on Wednesday to meet on Thursday and do the funeral on Friday. That's different.
Pressure.
So, yeah, but it's something that, you know, I know my ceremony composition's about 3 hours. I bill for 3 hours. It's about 3 hours. So I can do it. I mean, I could get a call now and do one tonight if I had to. Rather not, but, you know, actually, by the time I met with the family and everything, probably not. But yeah, it's really, and it's, it feels good to be confident that if they need me next week, we'll get it done. If they need me tomorrow, we'll get it done.
Yeah.
You know, because they have enough to worry about. They should. I want them to know we got this. You know, this is one piece of this that you can take off the, you know, the plate for things to stress you out.
So. Right, right, especially in times of grief.
Yeah.
Steve, what advice would you have for people who are looking to tell their own story? If they feel it's important to get it out there, mm-hmm. or tell a story, what advice do you have?
My advice would be find one place to start. Think of the story that is the most compelling to you, that means the most to you, that resonates the most deeply with you, and tell it like you're telling it to the person who understands you the most. And when you do that, and you tell that story to that person in that way, there's your starting point. If you can make the rest of the stuff measure up to that, then that's your template for a place to try to get to.
I like that. And it's good, right, for people, either whether it's on video or just to write it down. It's good for people to get that out there.
I think it is.
Excellent. So a couple questions, and then we'll let you go.
Okay.
We appreciate the time. If you were to go back and talk to the 20-year-old Steve, what advice would you give?
I would say start writing a little earlier. I dabbled in it. I did some stuff in college that was okay. I got real good grades in creative writing in high school and stuff, but it wasn't until I was around 30 that I started doing the running with the athletes with visual impairments. And I was working at Cornell, like I said, and the chairman of the psychology department said to me, he said, "I hear you tell these stories about your running with the blind athletes and stuff. You bring a lot of passion to that, and that really means a lot to you. You should be writing about this."
And that's how it began.
That planted the seed. It's like, yeah, this is cool stuff to write about, the trip to Korea and just the, you know, that story about that he didn't know what color his roommate's skin was and couldn't care less. You know, that was, he knew that was resonating deeply with me, and that I should, that's the place to start. Like mm-hmm. I said, you know, that's where you start those things. And so I would have told myself to start a little earlier. I wouldn't have done anything differently about the 2 years I spent stumbling around Santa Cruz, California, and going to massage school and being a hippie. And in case you were wondering how I got to be so cool, that's how I
was wondering.
Living in Santa Cruz, I wouldn't change any of that, you know, and traveling around on, you know, hitchhiking here and there and staying with friends and
because that's an education in itself.
It was such a look at life and being away from the small town and away from the family and having to forge some new paths and new relationships and things. So that was all really good. I got a late start on a few things writing. I didn't become a parent until I was 36, so that was a while, but I really, I would have just said, I would have gotten more serious about writing earlier. But now it's, you know, 30 years into it, I'm loving it. You know, it just feels like, I love the writing, I love the social work, and the convergence of those two things and the celebrant work. It just feels wonderful.
Yeah. Well, I'm honored to have you here today. Your life, your work is very purposeful. I see a lot of myself in you. And
I'm glad to mentor young guys like yourself.
But before we let you go, we spent a lot of time today talking about story, talking about legacy, talking about purpose. And I'd like to know, what do you want your legacy to be?
Well, I already have my plot in the Green Springs Natural Cemetery. I already found a stone. They have flat stones, so you can't put very much on there. It's going to say, "Here lies Steve. Please don't grieve. We all must leave." Boom.
Perfect.
That's a pretty encapsulated version. But I just hope that that people say that I really tried hard to tell people's story in ways that made them know that I appreciated them and know that people loved them, and to know that the footprint they left behind was maybe it's a small footprint in terms that they drove a Prius, but it's a large footprint in terms of how many people's hearts they touched. So I hope people say I tried hard.
Yeah, that's great. And at the end of the day, that's what it's all about, right? Touching people's hearts.
Yeah, and doing your best. You know, some days your best is awesome, and some days it's like, but if it's your best and you bring it, then you sleep well.
Excellent. Well, Steve Lawrence, thank you so much for being here, sharing your story today on American Real, and we will stay in touch.
Thank you, Roger. It's been a pleasure, and I really enjoyed it very much.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.